Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from San Francisco's downtown Hilton Hotel. I'm Carol Fleming, a member of the board of the club's Board of Governors, and your chair tonight. We also welcome the listeners of WECI FM in Richmond, Indiana, one of more than 225 stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners here in San Francisco, as well as on the radio, to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's speaker. Dr. Deborah Tannen is our speaker today, and she is University Professor of Linguistics at Georgetown University and best known to many of us as an author of books that have brought attention to the subtleties and complexities of linguistic usage and to the great mischief that can ensue when we fail to pay attention to our choice of words, our phrasing, our intonation, our timing, our pitch level, the characteristics of our listener, and the sensitivities they may have due to their age, their sex, education, background. Well, you get the picture. Deborah Tannen does pay attention to these things and has written books such as Talking from 9 to 5, You Just Don't Understand, and That's Not What I Meant. To show the general public just how language works or doesn't in human relationships. In addition, she is also a writer of poems and plays and articles for prominent magazines and newspapers. And not only is she an internationally recognized scholar, she has appeared on Oprah. Today, she will speak to us about the argument culture, the title of her latest book, her 16th book, which intends to open our ears to the dead end of polarized debate and to the possibilities afforded by dialogue. Given the complexities of modern life, the arguing of the left and the right politically, the pro and the con of the this and the that, and the assumption that an issue like a piece of paper, has only two sides. Tannen finds that we are ill-served by this simple-minded view of reality. She appears at the Commonwealth Club today to give us a glimpse of a better way, from confrontation to conversation. Please welcome Dr. Deborah Tannen.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction, and thank all of you for coming tonight. Those of you who are aware of my work, especially the work on how women and men communicate, may be wondering how I got from that to this topic that I call the argument culture, which is about our public discourse. So I thought I would start by answering the question that I am most often asked, which is, how did you come to write this book? In fact, I was even asked it this evening before I got up here. So I thought I would just start by backing up to the three books I've written for general audience and just say a few words about how I got from one to the next. My specialty, and by the way, I'm really a kind of a local person. I got my PhD in linguistics at Berkeley, right across the bay here. And my specialty was not women and men at all. It was communication style. The degree is linguistics. And my interest was how people who have different ethnic backgrounds, different class backgrounds, come from different parts of the country, different sexual orientation, different professions, any kind of influence that gives us a different conversational style can influence how we say what we mean. And I'll just give you one example from that, and this is the material that's in my first book for general audiences, which is called That's Not What I Meant. Just one example. And this was a comparison of a conversation between people who were from New York and people who were from California. So you're laughing already. You probably have some idea of what happened in that conversation. But one of the things that happened was that the people from California felt that the people from New York were interrupting them. Now, how could this have been? The New Yorkers, and I say we because I was one of the New Yorkers in the conversation, we didn't think we had interrupted anyone. And I was able to trace it to a very slight difference in a sense of timing. So anytime two people are speaking and one is expecting a short pause, let's say I'm doing this visually, but a relatively short pause, and the other person is expecting just a slightly longer pause, what happens is that the shorter pause comes first. And when that length of pause has come and gone, one person begins to feel uncomfortable. There's an uncomfortable silence brewing here. And so if you're a nice person, you want to save the conversation, you come in and fill that pause in order to prevent this uncomfortable silence. And what would happen over time is that the person waiting for the nice long pause, that pause never comes. And so they keep feeling interrupted and cut off. And each person blames the other. So whoever is expecting a longer pause thinks you only want to hear yourself talk, you're not interested in what I have to say. And the person expecting the shorter pause thinks, well, you don't have anything to say, you're not contributing anything to this conversation, maybe you don't like me, maybe you have nothing to say. And when this happens between two people who are married to each other, this can be very frustrating. Of course, during the courtship period, that doesn't happen because, you know, you're so eager to talk to each other. But over a couple of years, this can really begin to be a problem. So it's this difference in conversational style. And you don't walk away saying there's something about conversational style. You think there's something about your intentions toward me or the kind of person you are. Well, in the book, That's Not What I Meant, I had one chapter on communication between women and men. And I found that the attention that the book got focused disproportionately on that one chapter. That's what everybody seemed to want to hear more about. So I decided to write my next book for general audiences about conversations between women and men. And as many of you know, there are many, many examples in there. And when you write a book, you never know what of all the things you put into the book people are going to get out of it. Nothing prepared me for the fact that the one thing of all the anecdotes and research findings that I put into You Just Don't Understand, the one thing everybody wanted to talk about the most was why don't men like to stop and ask for directions? I didn't know there was a direction-asking crisis in the country, but it seemed that there was. And it is so funny. This has now become a cultural icon. People have sent me dinner napkins. Real men don't stop and ask directions. And, you know, there's a joke going around. Why did Moses wander in the desert for 40 years? You know, the answer. And many, many others. And how did I come up with that example? I was sitting at my dining room table with my friend Susan, and I said, Susan, what do you argue with your husband about? And she said, you know, Wes never wants to stop and ask for directions. It really frustrates me. And I said, gee, well, why does he say he doesn't? And she said, well, he says if you ask somebody, they're going to tell you the wrong thing anyway, so why should you stop? Better to be lost because of your own ignorance, not somebody else's. And she said, but that frustrates me because we end up driving around and I think we should say, and I thought about that and I thought, gee, well, you know, this kind of fits my framework. The framework was that when growing up, women are, little girls' groups become very attuned to who's in and who's out. And so girls are very attuned to anybody talking in a way that's kind of pushing them away. And boys' groups are become very attuned to who's putting you down and pushing you around, because the boys' groups, they do push each other around. And if you want to make sure that your life isn't constantly, you don't get pushed around all the time, you better avoid that one down position. And so through that frame, if you stop and say to somebody, I'm lost and I need your help, well, from the woman's point of view, you haven't really lost anything. You made a fleeting connection to a stranger. But from his point of view, you've put yourself in a one-down position to a stranger when you say, I'm lost, I need your help. And that's uncomfortable. So it makes sense to spend 10 minutes or 20 minutes, 30 minutes, you know, however long it takes to find it on your own. So that was just one of many differences that I wrote about, and You Just Don't Understand. After that, a lot of people said to me, well, this is really very helpful. talking at home to help me with talking to my spouse, but what about work? I spend more time at work than I do at home. I need a book about that. So the next book that I wrote was Talking from 9 to 5, Women and Men in the Workplace. And I'll give you just one quick example from that. One of the things I found in observing in the workplace, and I did spend time following people around and tape recording, interviewing as well, one thing that I found was women were often being told, don't apologize, it's not your fault. And many of them felt, but that wasn't an apology. Because often women were saying, I'm sorry, and it wasn't, I apologize, it was, I'm sorry that happened. So it was a way of taking the other person's experience into account. And sometimes women would say, I'm sorry, when they knew they hadn't done anything wrong, but they thought, if I say I'm sorry for X, then you'll say I'm sorry for Y. So that's a good way to get you to apologize, by apologizing first. But sometimes it didn't work. She would say, I'm sorry for X, and the other person will say, well, make sure you don't do it again. And then it's like being on a seesaw, and the other person got off, and you went plopping to the ground. That's just one of many examples from the workplace, talking from 9 to 5. Well, an interesting thing happened. Here I had written both, You Just Didn't Understand, Talking from 9 to 5, about communication between women and men, and the goal and the premise of it was, if women and men can understand each other's conversational styles, we can get along better. Stop blaming each other. Take the blame out of it. It doesn't mean that you might not become frustrated, but at least you wouldn't be as likely to walk away saying, I'm right and you're wrong and there's something wrong with me, or there's something wrong with you, or something wrong with our relationship. And yet so often when I was out talking about it or being interviewed, I would find it put under the rubric, the battle of the sexes, the gender wars. And I will tell you one anecdote that really captures what I have in mind with the argument culture, because this is really what got me thinking along the lines that I've written about in this new book. And it was right here in San Francisco. I was invited onto a local talk show called People Are Talking. Maybe some of you remember that show. And I was told, we're going to have you on, and we're also going to have a man on to represent the other side. Now, I wasn't exactly sure why a man would necessarily show the other side, because the book was about women's and men's conversational styles, but I didn't see any problem. I said that was fine. Well, they had me on the show. When I came into the studio, I encountered a man who said to me, I read You Just Don't Understand. I liked it very much. But when I get out there, I'm going to attack you. Don't take it personally. That's why they invite me on, so that's what I'm going to do. And sure enough, the show started, and I made a few comments, and this man, he practically leapt out of his seat, and he began attacking me, and then he quickly moved on to what was obviously a pre-planned diatribe against women. And what really stuck in my mind was the effect that this had on the studio audience. It had a format. Many shows that I was on had this format. I was there. He was there. There were three women that were invited on, and many shows had couples. This one just had women talking about problems they had communicating with men in their lives, and a studio audience. And typically what would happen on a show like this, and this is what Oprah was such a genius about, when these guests would talk about their experience and I would comment, and then Oprah would say, the same thing happened to me, and then people in the audience would say, yeah, that's just like my experience. And she created this wonderful sense of connection and community between the guests, the people in the studio, the people at home. What happened on this show was just the opposite. When the guests started talking about problems they had communicating with their spouses, the studio audience turned vicious and began accusing them of all the same evil motives that this man had just been saying women were guilty of. So they were mimicking exactly the approach that he had modeled. That you approach people as your enemy. And this is so so much a part of how our culture has been developing now. This is what you see in Jerry Springer, that he took the format that Oprah created connection with. And what does he do? He just gets people fighting. And it's entertaining. Yeah, it is entertaining. It's kind of fun to watch. But the studio audience turns against the guests and thinks how much superior they are to the guests. And at the end of the show, he turns to them and bawls them out and tells them how they shouldn't act that way. And so it's breaking the connections between people. It's setting people against each other. And this is the reason that I am concerned with what I'm calling the argument culture, that our tendency to approach everything as a metaphorical battle, to approach each other in an adversarial spirit, has a corrosive effect on the spirits of the individuals, on us, on our human spirits. And it breaks the connections between people rather than creating the connections that we need to develop as a community. So what do I mean by the argument culture? It's the tendency to approach everything as a metaphorical fight. And it comes from our belief, which is very deeply rooted in our culture, in American culture in general, and Western culture in particular, that opposition is the path to truth. So the best way to cover news, well, you find spokespeople to present the most polarized views you can, and you present this as both sides. If somebody says one thing, find somebody who'll say something else, and that provides balance. The best way to settle disputes is litigation. Two sides, each represented by a lawyer. The lawyers fight it out. One side wins, one side loses. The best way to begin an essay, well, you attack someone. The best way to show you're really thinking is to criticize. We see it in our schools. Teacher brings in an article to read, invites everybody in the class to tear it apart. What's wrong with this? Let's poke holes. Let's find all the faults in this. And nothing is wrong with any of these processes that I'm describing when they are coming along with a lot of other kinds of inquiry as well. It only becomes a problem when it's the only thing that you're doing. Biography, for example. Well, you don't want a biography that's just iconography, you know, just idealizing the person that's being written about. We want to know about the person, warts and all. But what we have now is demonography. All the warts, just the warts, nothing but the warts. We only want to expose people's weaker side and all the mistakes that everybody has made. I want to clarify, I'm not talking about civility. There's a lot of talk about civility, a lot of concern about civility. I agree with it, I support it, but that's not what this book is about. Civility suggests a kind of pinky in the air, a kind of politeness that you spread over human relations like marmalade over toast. What I'm talking about is something deep, how our ways of thinking about, talking about things affects how we think about them, and then that affects how we act on them. So if you approach issues as two polarized extremes, say you're just putting a show together, and you just think, oh, what's the best way to do this? Well, let's get somebody here. You know, he's too moderate because that's not going to make a good fight. So get the person with the most extreme view here and the most extreme view there. This will make a great show. Because we think of our news shows as entertainment now, and we want the liveliest show. What happens then is that those polarized extremes define the debate, and people end up thinking there's no solution because the two sides are so polarized. And you can see this with the abortion debate, for example, so that one side is ready to bomb clinics rather than allow abortions to be legal, and then another side is saying there should be no restrictions, whatever. Most people are somewhere in the middle. And by the way, even putting it up two sides in that way is, you can see one thing that it does, it creates a moral equivalence as if people who would actually commit murder are on a par with people who are trying to uphold the law. And then you end up saying, well, there's no solution. But if you redefine it as trying to minimize the number of abortions, say, by making contraception more available, well, wouldn't that that would actually satisfy most people in the country. Well, it wouldn't satisfy people on both extremes, but why should we allow the extremes to define the debate? Same thing with the drug, what's called the drug war. It has been defined as, on the one hand, legalize drugs, and on the other hand, lock everybody up for the longest amount of time possible. Well, maybe the solution is drug treatment programs, making treatment programs available. But even politicians are afraid to speak in favor of that because they're going to be assigned to one camp or the other, and people on the other side are ready to attack them. So this is not about let's be nice and let's stop arguing. In fact, it's just the opposite. What I'm talking about are ritualized, phony, knee-jerk, trumped-up fights where you're just fighting to make a good show because you think that's the way to approach something. And that actually is preventing us having the real argument. So it's not let's stop arguing. It's let's stop having the phony arguments so we can have the real arguments. And having these phony arguments gets in the way of having the real arguments. So, for example, that show that I described, that People Are Talking show, they could have invited someone on who had done research and came up with different findings, and we could have had an interesting discussion, or we use the word debate, but we use it to mean open discussion about whether what I'm saying about women and men is really true. That would have been great, but we didn't have that. Because we had a phony argument, we couldn't have a real argument. And that's what I want to talk about today. In fact, there's a quote that I like to read because it really emphasizes this point, and it's by a poet, Charles Simic, who was a Yugoslavian-born poet, and that takes on special resonance today because of what's happening in Yugoslavia. But I like it because he had lived under a regime where you could not have open arguments and open debate. And he said, there are moments in life when true invective is called for, when it becomes an absolute necessity out of a deep sense of justice to denounce, mock, vituperate, lash out in the strongest possible language. And I read that because I endorse that. I'm not saying we should never argue. We must be free to express our opposition and protest. It's an obligation to do that when it's something you feel passionately about. But if you're making everything into a fight, then nobody's listening when the real fights come. In a sense, you end up, you could say if there's a fight outside your window, you run to the window and throw it open to see what's happening. But if there's a fight outside your window every night, you shut that window and do your best to block it out. And that, unfortunately, is what is happening now. I want to focus on one or two examples from each of three major areas. I want to talk about the press, about politics, and about law. And I have chapters on these in the argument culture. But I also have chapters on gender. And I know some of you may be interested in that, and I will talk about that in the question period, if you like. Also about technology, about how other cultures deal with opposition. But because I can't do everything in my opening remarks, I'll focus on the press, politics, and law. Just quickly, politics. Now, you might be thinking, what is she talking about? Of course politics is adversarial. We have a two-party system. They have to fight each other. How else could it be? Yes, we have a two-party system, but ideally, you have a campaign, and campaign is a military metaphor. You have a campaign, politicians oppose each other, and then one is elected, and that person should join the government and work with whoever is in the government to govern the country. What we have now is a year-round campaign, and campaign tactics have infected the running of the government, so that people in both parties have become convinced it'd be better not to let anything get done than to let it get done and let the other party get credit for it. In 1996, 14 of the most respected, most experienced, most moderate senators decided voluntarily not to seek re-election. And the reason that many of them gave was that they felt they could not get anything done because the spirit of compromise had dried up. This is external evidence that things have changed. We have a two-party system, but within that system, the argument culture has gotten worse. There is more rancor, more of a feeling that you don't want to work with the other party, less friendship between members of the two parties. And so there's a lot been written about this. But this word compromise is now a dirty word. In the past, compromise was respected. Henry Clay was the great compromiser. We couldn't in our era have someone we called a great compromiser. We have a great communicator, but not a great compromiser. What about law? Obviously, law is adversarial, right? Two sides have a dispute. How else could it be? Well, it's interesting to think about how else it could be. The continental system in France and Germany, the fact-finding aspect of the law is not done by the lawyers. And when you think about it, the lawyer for each side has a motivation to manipulate facts to just bring out the ones that support that side. Just like a debate, you know, if your opponent in a debate says something you know has some truth to it, you're not going to acknowledge that. Why would you? You want to win the debate. Or if you're having an argument with someone you're close to and they say something that you know has some truth to it, you're not going to acknowledge that. You can ignore that. Wait till they say something really outrageous. That's what you're going to leap on because you want to win the argument. Well, that's what happens in law. Well, in France and Germany in the continental system, fact-finding is controlled by a judge or a panel of judges, and their goal is to find out what happened. Now, we can see there are liabilities with that. If you had someone that was biased or didn't understand the point of view of one of the sides, there could be a problem. But it's a different set of problems than we have in our system. Within the field of law, people are talking about exactly the same kinds of changes that the senators are talking about in politics. People are leaving the law saying almost word for word what the politicians are saying. It isn't any fun anymore because these adversarial tactics have become the norm. And I'll just give you one example. There was a very well-publicized case between ABC and the Philip Morris tobacco company. And ABC had a show about whether the, and it's interesting because since it has come out, the tobacco company has since then said publicly that they manipulated the level of nicotine in cigarettes so that people would be addicted. But at this time, it was not out. ABC claimed it, and the Philip Morris company sued them for it. There was a lot of rancor back and forth, a lot of money at stake, and this often happens in cases where there's a lot of money at stake. Well, there's something called the discovery process. That means each side is allowed to depose witnesses and request documents from the other side. That's going to be relevant to the case. But what's happening now is that one side will request far more documents than they really need to wear out the other side. First of all, maybe their patience will give out. Secondly, their money will run out. You ask to depose witnesses in order to upset them, ask questions that they don't want to answer, humiliate them, and then maybe they'll settle just to stop the whole thing. Well, there was one said millions of pages of documents that the ABC lawyers were requesting, and Philip Morris didn't want to give them. And finally, they gave up these millions of pages of documents. And ABC claimed that they gave them on paper, yellow paper with squiggly lines in the background, so you couldn't scan it into a computer. So it didn't do them any good if they couldn't scan it into a computer. Furthermore, the ABC lawyers accused, the paper was chemically treated, so it made people who handled it sick. Now, this has been written about in law journals. This is where I got all this material from. And one writer commented, this has been much written about, you know, these dirty tricks in law. But a lot of people just wanted to know where they could get that smelly paper. So it's not the inherent adversarialness of the system that's the problem. It's the way the adversarial nature has been exaggerated and is abused and is regularly abused. And there are many other examples like this that I talk about. And one law professor, in fact, Carrie Mankel-Meadow, has commented, in most civil cases, there's some right on both sides. And so if we have a system that awards everything to one side, in a sense, you can't have a just conclusion. Okay, what about the press? In a sense, the press is the system that is most uppermost in most of our minds. There are two aspects to it with the press. One is the conviction that opposition always leads to truth, so you need two sides to every issue. If you get someone who says one thing, you want to find someone who will say the other, no matter how far, you know, you have to scour the fringes of lunacy to find somebody to represent the other side. And also an ethic of aggression by which many journalists have begun to feel, and I think this is very much the legacy of Watergate and of Vietnam, where Woodward and Bernstein became heroes by bringing down someone in a position of power. And Geneva Overholser, she's actually a journalist who has written about this, herself has commented that now many journalists feel that the only journalism worth doing is the type that brings down the mighty. And so there's kind of a competition to find the next scandal. Watergate came to light because a break-in happened to be, by chance, discovered by a night watchman. The scandals we are now encountering are being manufactured by a giant scandal industry. Both the press looking for it, political opponents looking for it, opposition research, that is a very big industry within politics. It's a scandal industry, and people are getting scandaled out. You have what we might call scandal inflation, so that there are so many scandal after one scandal after another that when there was real serious wrongdoing, nobody pays any attention. Another kind of metaphor for this, Larry Sabato, the political scientist, has put it this way. Before Watergate, the press was like a lapdog. That's not good. Just take anything that was given them without questioning. After Watergate, the press was a watchdog. Well, that's good. They should be. Now, he says, the press has become like attack dogs, going after everyone in public life for everything. And then my footnote to that is, a dog that's busy attacking is not watching. And so it's not that the press should not have an adversarial relationship with people in power. It's not that the press should not be on the lookout for wrongdoing. But actually, being constantly on the attack actually means that they're often not there when serious wrongdoing should really be exposed. And why shouldn't people, a lot of people say, well, why should the press care? Because after all, it sells, doesn't it? Well, it's an irony. In the short run, it seems to sell, but in the long run, it doesn't. Consumership and readership of news is down. And people, you may have actually heard Dr. Andrew Weil talk about this. He actually is recommending that people go on a news fast for their mental health. Something is wrong with our with the delivery of news if it's bad for your mental health and you have to block it out. And I think what is wrong is exactly what I'm calling the argument culture, the element of it that I'm saying is corrosive to the human spirit, being surrounded by an atmosphere of unrelenting contention. And I'll give you another example of that. I was on a show called The Charles Grodin Show. And I don't know if any of you ever saw it, but I had told some friends of mine that I was going to be on the show, and so my devoted friends try to watch when I'm going to be on a show. And I had a message on my answering machine that night from one friend. She said, you know, I tried to watch you, but I turned on the station, and there were two men just yelling at each other and talking over each other, and I just couldn't listen to it. It was so irritating to my nerves. I had to turn it off, and I'm so sorry I missed you. And what had she tuned into? Grodin had started the interview by saying, you know, here's my guest, Deborah Tennant. She wrote this book, The Argument Culture. And I have to admit, I'm guilty of what she's talking about, and I'm going to show you an example. And he put on an example of himself getting into one of these shouting matches with a guest. And it was just what I was talking about, and it had exactly the effect I was saying it had. My friend turned it off, even though she had a reason to want to watch, because she wanted to watch it to see a friend on. Another really big problem with this is that it is becoming harder and harder to find anyone to serve hold a public office. When you think about it, going into public service in the past, it's a sacrifice. It involves a sacrifice. Most people take a very large cut in their salary. Their lives are disrupted. They have to uproot their families and move to Washington. They work round the clock. Why would anyone do it? They would do it for a feeling of public service, but also a feeling that their reputations would be enhanced. You would do it for the honor. What's happening now is that if a person opts to go into public service, he or she makes that sacrifice but has to realize that they are putting their reputation on the line. There is a very good chance that people will then be motivated to dig up anything bad about them they can find and expose it. Journalists who want to make a name for themselves looking to do that, people wanting to put shows on looking to do that. And it's becoming harder and harder to find anyone willing to serve in public office. In fact, you may remember Bobby Ray Inman had been nominated by President Clinton to be Secretary of Defense, and he stepped down. And he would have been nominated. It was no question about that, but he withdrew his name, and he gave a press conference that I had found so moving. I thought, here he is finally saying this. And I was so thrilled, and I thought, everyone is really going to listen. He had a press conference in which he said that he had stood for public office before for both Republicans and Democrats, and he had had confirmation hearings that were no problem, and now his friends in the Senate were saying, get ready, Bobby, we're going to have to give you a hard time. Don't worry, you'll be nominated, but that's just how it is now. We're going to have to be hard on you. And that journalists were digging around, trying to dig up everything, anything bad about him they could find. And he said to one journalist, what about this, this, and this, all these good things I've done? And he said he was told, look, I'm just writing the story my editors want. And he said he was told by an editor, we have to write a negative story about you every day. That's our job. And he said here in Austin, Texas, where he lived, people say, you'd have to be crazy to put up with that, to sacrifice for public service. And he said, in Washington, everybody tells me, you have to realize that's what you have to do if you're going to stand up for a job like that. So I thought, isn't this wonderful? You know, he said this, it's going to be out there. And the newspapers the next day, all the headlines, what's wrong with Bobby Ray Inman? Why is he so thin-skinned? This is a man who knew how to play the game. He should know that this is what you have to put up with. Actually, one person said, he knew how to play the game. He thought he could play the game, but the game had gotten a lot harder and a lot hotter. And one of the wonderful things, a line I really loved, Meg Greenfield wrote in response to everybody saying he needed to get thicker skin. Thin skin is the only kind of skin human beings come with. And I think that's true, and I think it's one of the problems with one of the tragedies, because it is a tragedy with what I'm calling the argument culture, is that people are hurt. In all of these situations where, you know, you're hurt by watching it on television, you're hurt by being attacked, not because somebody really has a problem with what you did, but just because they think it's appropriate to attack you in that situation. And the entire country is losing because it is becoming harder and harder to find anybody willing to stand for public office. And ironically, I think we're getting more and more likely to have people who are so ambitious that they're willing to put up with anything to hold public office. And so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. One more thing about that underlines the main point I'm getting at here, which is that I'm not talking about ending real arguments, but just talking about ending ritual arguments, show arguments. There was an interesting study. It was actually reported in Jim Fallow's book, wrote a book a couple years ago, but he's a journalist. There was a study in which both journalists and average citizens were asked, do you think that people in public life, public figures, on the whole, are more honorable than the average citizen or less honorable than the average citizen? And the vast majority of average citizens said less honorable. And the vast majority of journalists said more honorable. But where did the average citizen get the idea that people in public life are less honorable? From the journalists. So how could this be? And I think what it is, journalists know that it's the argument culture. They know that there's a lot that public figures are doing that's not bad. They know that they spent 2 weeks digging around before they found that one bad thing that they wrote about. But they just realize this is the game. This is the story my editor wants. This is, we have to give it an edge. We have to pump it up. These are expressions that they use. But they know it's just ritual. They know it's not the whole story. But the average reader doesn't know, because that's the story they read, and they read that story every day. And the harvest that they reap is cynicism. The feeling that, why should I even bother voting? All those politicians are crooked. And so a lot of the animosity and enmity that in the past was directed toward outside enemies during the Cold War is now being directed at the government, at ourselves. It's like an organism that's turning on itself and eating itself up. And it's this spirit of argument, the argument culture in journalism that is, and it's not only journalism, and it's in all these fields. And it's a funny thing, when I first drafted this book, I put the chapter on journalism at the end because I didn't want it to sound like just another press bashing, media bashing thing. And I wanted to show how it's part of a very complex interweaving of forces in our culture. Of course, my editors told me put it up front because people are, after all, you deal with the media every day in your lives, so that's what people are going to respond to. So that's where it is. But it is part of this very complex system of forces that both ratchets up the level of opposition, overemphasizes using opposition as a path to truth, and this ethic of aggression by which we value aggressive tactics more than we value conciliatory tactics. It was very striking to me that I saw this in all the different fields. So, for example, reading what journalists themselves have written about their profession, I read a very interesting comment that when journalists focus on the when they ask tough questions, for example, at a press conference, they're really not worrying so much about the audience as they're worrying about their colleagues. They don't want to be seen as asking easy questions. They don't want to be seen as writing a puff piece. They want to be seen as writing something, as being aggressive. And lawyers have the same thing, Rambo tactics in law, because they want their colleagues to think they're tough. Okay, well, I've said something about those three fields, and as if you want to ask me in the question period about some of the other areas, and I see there are questions already on the table there. What I want to leave with then is that what I'm talking about is a very pervasive force in our society that is ratcheting up the level of animosity and the spirit, the adversarial spirit. I'm suggesting that perhaps we could just rethink the way we approach each other. Instead of only wanting to be provocative, how about being thought-provoking? Instead of both sides, how about another side? How about thinking about all sides? How about the drama? Not, we can have the drama of two sides fighting it out, but how about the drama of seeing two people find common ground and changing their minds? That's very dramatic, and I think people would feel that's dramatic too. And I am hopeful that in all these three fields, there is some indication of change. The Committee of Concerned Journalists has been addressing this issue. The Congress members, you may have noticed, recently went off to Hershey, Pennsylvania to learn to get along with each other better. And in law, alternative dispute resolution is receiving more and more attention. And so there is some hope. I think people are concerned. Maybe I'll leave you just with one little epithet maybe we can keep in mind, and that is smashing heads does not open minds. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah Tannen, University Professor of Linguistics at Georgetown University and author of The Argument Culture. Now, Victor Ravenko, past president of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct our question and answer period.
Thank you, Carol Fleming, today's chair. Dr. Tannen, we have a number of questions, but these questions are styled to be those that stimulate dialogue rather than argument. There are a series of questions that deal with the gender issue, and I'll just raise it this way. Do you find that women are more concerned about communication than men are?
And a healthy argument is okay, too. When I talk about personal relationships, one issue that does come up is that girls and women often place a value on communication as evidence that the relationship is working. So the way I put it sometimes is, for girls, talk is the glue that holds a relationship together, which is why at the end of the day, if a woman says, how was your day, and you know she tells everything that happened and how she felt and what that made her think and what that made her feel, and then she says to her partner, how was your day, and he says, okay. Really? Didn't anything happen? Same old rat race. You know, she may feel something's missing because talk or communication is evidence that the relationship is good and we're close. Whereas boys' groups tend to be somewhat different. Closeness is a function of doing things together. So if we're sitting and watching the ball game together, we're close because we're doing something together. And loyalty is a very big part of it. If there's a fight, he'll be on my side. I'm going to relate this to the argument culture, though, in this way, that for many boys and men, ritual fighting is a way of getting close. So if think of war. For many men, the closest bonding they have ever experienced is war, because the men in the same platoon, the men in the same battalion, are so bonded together in opposition to the enemy. And you see this among boys play fighting, and you will see it among men teasing each other. In my workplace research, if a woman commented on another woman's clothing, it was usually a compliment. Whether or not she really liked it, you know, you got to say, that's so nice. You got your hair cut. Looks great. You can't say, you got your hair cut. It looks terrible. You can't say that. You got to say it's nice. Well, many men, if a man commented on another man's clothing, it was a playful insult. Like, where'd you get that tie? It looks like your breakfast is still on it. And this, yet these playful insults was a way of showing affection. That is ritual fighting. And many men actually feel close through aggression and fighting. But you're close to the people on the same team. Or it's just playful, you know, just a playful, just like little kids. If you watch little boys, they'll pick something up and spar with each other. It's not that girls don't fight. It's not that girls are not aggressive. Girls will absolutely fight. But they don't fight for fun. That's what the difference is. They don't set up a play fight as a form of entertainment. They fight because they mean it. And so in that sense, you might say that there's a level on which women are interested in talk and communication, maybe parallel in some ways to the way that many men are interested in watching ritual opposition, like watching sports or debates or arguments. So that's my answer to that. Thank you.
This is a Dear Abby type question. Dear Deborah, my boss winds up giving me too great a proportion of work while giving my coworker so little work that the coworker avoids coming into the office after out-of-the-office meetings. I'm getting burned out carrying too much of the work. What is the correct way to confront my boss about the problem without causing too much friction?
I'm always hesitant to give advice when I don't know the details of a particular situation. And this is one thing that often frustrates people, because I say we need to consider your style, the style of the person you're speaking to, and how your styles react to each other before you know how to communicate. So some bosses will respond very well if you walk right in and you say, this is my problem, this is my evidence for it, and this is how I think we should solve it. Some bosses will respond very well to that. Others will not respond well to that at all. Some bosses will not want to hear anything negative at all. And the best thing would be to get someone else to try to call it to their attention. And sometimes people can team up in an office where I will press your case and you will press my case. Some bosses will do better if you somehow arrange for the evidence to make itself known to the boss without it being clear that you're the one that brought that, by sending copies of memos, for example, by sending copies of everything so that the boss sees how much work that you're doing, by if you work late, make sure you stop by the office and say hello so he knows you've worked late. Leave him a voicemail message at 9 p.m., and it will say that you were there at 9 p.m. So I think there are a lot of different ways you can handle it, and it's really going to depend on the style of that person.
This is a prospective question. What evidence do you have to put forward that the argument culture is a new thing, and where does this topic lead you next?
As I indicated, I don't claim that it's a new thing. I claim that it's getting worse. And I trace the origins to it way back in Western culture. It goes back to Aristotle and to the Greeks, the belief that opposition is the path to truth. That you can explore an idea by debating the two opposite sides, by thinking of male and female as opposite polarities, our tendency to approach everything as a dualistic this or that. And you can contrast it with Asian culture. So if you just think about the yin-yang model symbol that is common in Chinese culture, if it were ours, it would be a straight line down the middle, one side white, one side black. But it isn't. You have a wavy line as each one kind of curves into the other, and you have a little circle of each within the other. And the approach is much more less dualistic. So I think it goes way back in our culture. And I trace it also to our educational system, the medieval university, which incidentally, and Walter Ong has written about this, he places a lot of emphasis on the fact that the medieval university was all male. And he says it was like a puberty rite. Take young men out of the home, put them in an all-male environment. They're suffering. The teachers beat them. They didn't have heat. They were cold, and they were treated very badly. They bonded together like kids in war. The teachers were their ritual enemies, and they always learned by fighting. So they were public debates where they had to fight each other. They read about martial arts, and this is the environment in which they learned. And he says that this is very fundamental to our educational system. So I'm not saying it's new, but I am saying it has gotten worse. And there is evidence in each of those areas to show that it has gotten worse. There are plenty of studies within journalism that show that the percentage of negative coverage of public figures is up. Not that we didn't have attacks on public figures. It's the percentage of negative attack articles versus neutral ones that has gone up. The evidence of the politicians leaving office who are looking back and saying it's gotten worse, the 14 senators that I referred to. Bob Livingstone, who just left kind of as a casualty of the argument culture, his farewell speech to his colleagues was, we can't be so partisan. We have to learn to talk to each other. We have to learn to compromise. That's the only way democracy is going to work. George Bush made a similar speech not long ago to his former colleagues. Things have gotten out of hand. It's far more rancorous than it was in my time. It's getting in the way of getting things done. And again, in my book, I have many, many more examples of that. And within the field of law, if you read the law journals, the reason there is all this emphasis now on alternative dispute resolution and therapeutic jurisprudence is another one. Many approaches, negotiation and remediation now is becoming the focus because there's a feeling within the law that the system is getting abused. The movie and the book A Civil Action is a good example of that, too. So that's just a few of the kinds of evidence that I use.
Do you feel that the increased immediate response to human requests from the advents in communication technology, ATM machines, automatic telephone response systems, internet chat rooms, have had a significant impact on conversation styles, and do they help or hinder dialogue?
Technology has a very, very strong influence on how we communicate. On the most obvious level, we pick up metaphors from computers. We talk about being online. We talk about bugs in the system. So that's maybe the most superficial level. What I think is the most significant level is that technology has ratcheted up both the level, the possibility of connection and the possibility of animosity and opposition. Because of email and the internet, you can talk to and make connections with people in vastly distant places. Parents talk to their children at college every day on email that would never call up their children every day. The kids wouldn't talk to them if their parents called every day. And certainly the kids wouldn't call home every day, but they're at their computers and they send email messages every day. You can get information you couldn't have gotten. You can talk to people in far distant places. Great levels of connection, but at the same time, the levels of animosity have gone up. Flaming became a problem on the internet very, very quickly. This is very vicious, hateful, attacking messages that are sent to people over the internet. And of course, as you know, people are sharing information about how to make bombs, setting up, and as we all know, this was a factor in the Littleton, Colorado tragedy that the one of the young men, Eric Harris, had a website in which he had spewed all this hatred and anger out. I think one of the reasons technology does this is that the anonymity makes possible greater levels of animosity. So, for example, if you're riding along in your car and somebody cuts you off, you feel a upsurge of anger, and you might make a gesture that you otherwise wouldn't make. And then you look over and you see the driver is your neighbor. You're embarrassed because you wouldn't do that to somebody you know. But when it's just the anonymous driver, the anger wells up in a much more virulent form, and I think that technology does that as well. It makes the person on the other side that much anonymous, and so you can demonize them. You don't see them as quite human, and it's exactly the opposite of what so many peacemakers and peace movement people have found, which is that if you take people who are enemies and bring them together and let them get to know each other as people, their animosity dissolves. And so what this technology does is the opposite. Pulls people apart, dehumanizes them, and then you can hate them, which is what you do in war. You don't see the other person as a human, and then you can do terrible things to them.
How do you respond to the idea that our culture is more adversarial now because it's more open to people from widely divergent and diverse backgrounds who are more likely to argue about things that matter to them?
That's a very interesting question. You could make the argument, and by the way, I distinguish between making an argument and having an argument. Making an argument is good, laying ideas together. And having an argument is when you're trying to win and not listen or understand. You could make the argument that it's the diversity that is creating the problems, but I don't think so. I think you can air widely divergent views in so many different ways, and it is our culture's inclination to approach others in this adversarial spirit. And again, I will contrast it with the Chinese example. Many people, this is, point has been made by many historians, that Chinese culture is a very diverse culture, but people of many different ethnic backgrounds in China. But there seems to be an ability to absorb new people in without butting heads. And I describe the example, historians have written about this in Japan, that they have a tradition called victor without vanquished, where when two groups are opposing each other and one wins, the expectation is that the side that wins will immediately invite the side that lost back in and give some things back to them so that they are not permanently disenfranchised. So I think there are many different ways to deal with difference, and that we are dealing with it in a way that magnifies our inclination, which is use opposition, use ritual fighting, pit people against each other and see what comes out.
What trends in our society give you some hope that we can begin to move beyond the argument culture?
This gives me a chance to expand a little bit on the way I ended my talk, which is that there are trends within each of these fields that I mentioned from within, that there's frustration. So, for example, in the field of law, alternative dispute resolution is the fastest growing subfield of the law. Many people who have gone into the law themselves say, we're not helping people, we are setting people against each other more than we're helping them. Many people come through the legal system feeling embittered, and this is, Carrie Mankel Meadow makes this point too. It's dangerous for a democracy if people are embittered and cynical about their legal system. And so people themselves are turning, lawyers themselves, many of them are going into the field of dispute resolution. And the Committee of Concerned Journalists issued a report not long ago in which they are examining their own field. Journalists are concerned because, in fact, just the other day, USA Today had a poll for how much respect people have for the various professions. And journalists, the press, was second from the bottom for people's approval and trust in them. So that they don't like that. You know, they're upset about that, and they want to gain back some of that public respect. And so journalists themselves are asking, how can we do things better? There is a certain movement now, you've probably noticed, toward news you can use. That is, China, U.S. News and World Report is doing this, and you'll see it on a lot of the television shows. But I think the next step is going to be to have a less adversarial approach to the news, so you don't have to just not talk about news to be less adversarial, but we can actually reframe how we do the news. But there is evidence that in all these fields, there is concern.
We've gotten to the point in the program where we have time for one last question. It is this. What advice would you give a young man or woman entering the workforce today about argument or dialogue to succeed as best as possible?
The hardest thing, but the most important thing to keep in mind, I think, is this caution. Don't demonize the people that you disagree with. It's very easy to approach people in an adversarial spirit, and we are encouraged more and more to do so, both at work and in our private lives. Just a brief example, my father, who's quite elderly, there was some work being done in his condominium, and he was told to put his car in another space while they fixed it, and he was given the slot to put it in. They told him where to put it. He put it in that slot. The next morning, there was a note on his car, "Don't park your damn car in my spot again." Well, the person who left that note clearly had in mind this evil villain who had done a terrible thing intentionally. And I would suggest, let's just assume that maybe the person who did the thing that made you angry didn't do it out of evil motives. We tend to give ourselves the benefit of the doubt. You know, if we snap at someone, our feeling is, well, I'm a nice person, but you provoked me. But when someone snaps at us, we think, what a rotten person you are. And we don't ask, did I do something to provoke them? Is this something about the way I approached this person that got under their skin? Could I have approached them in a different way? Could there be something going on in their life that made them come on in that way? And so I think it's just that ability to step back and ask, could it be something other than the evil motive that I think it probably is? And try to reframe and approach it as if the person is not your enemy. And you may get a lot better results by approaching it that way. Thank you.
Our thanks to Deborah Tannen, professor of linguistics at Georgetown University and author of The Argument Culture, for joining us today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco and those listening on radio, and invite you to join us again soon. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's premier public affairs forum, is adjourned.